Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
It's September 1st, and that's a sort of unofficial start date for the college experience. We know university plans for their students as living and learning have varied, and we also know that those who have returned students to campus in the midst of this pandemic have generated a lot of debate and concern over the potential public health risks. But according to Peter Ubertasio, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Stonehill College, the benefits outweigh the risks as long as there's a well-thought-out plan in place. And he joins me now to talk more about that. Peter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a couple of weeks into this new school year process, and obviously it's been a tough time for all of us, at least the last 6-8 months. How are you?
I'm tired, to be honest. I think I speak for a lot of my colleagues. It's a mixture of excitement. We're really thrilled to have our students back, whether they're here in person or joining us remotely. But it's been exhausting to try and put these plans together, you know, and to have to deal with public health issues in real time.
You know, I hear that so often. September 1st feels like the unofficial start of so many things, and yet so many people are going into it exhausted. Do you feel trepidation about that, Peter? Like the ability to run the marathon is at risk?
You know, I do a little bit. I worry about our staff and faculty colleagues who haven't had a break. You know, normally the summer is a time to regroup, to maybe focus on scholarship. To really think about your classes in the fall. And we've all had to adapt so quickly to this new reality that people have been going nonstop. So, you know, we're trying to monitor with all of our folks here and approach this with a good deal of humbleness and grace and some humor to try and get everyone through.
I know you feel strongly that students should be on campus as long as it can be done with safety. And I know you recently wrote a piece comparing what you call sideline moments in sports to these benefits that you believe in of in-person learning. Can you make your case and talk about the sideline moments dimension of it?
Thank you. You know, I have athletes at home, and my son is a basketball player, and I've often marveled at the way the look on the faces of the kids when they're in a basketball team, when a coach calls the timeout, and they quickly gather around to get instruction. And I see the same look on my college students and their college athletics, right? And it's really fascinating. It's something about the way an athlete looks at a coach during those moments of high adrenaline. And you see something similar in the classroom experience, which is really only one part. It is the most crucial part of what happens in higher ed, but it's only one part. You see the, you know, minus the sweat, minus the adrenaline, students and faculty gathered on the sidelines, whether it's after class, walking to a faculty member's office, leaving a lab together, just conversing in a dining hall. You know, the student experience really does extend from the classroom. And we've lost that, you know, because of the pandemic. From March on, you know, we've been able to gather digitally in a classroom environment, which has been wonderful. And it's really important that we have those tools to use, but we haven't really been able to gather on the sidelines. And those moments are crucial.
Peter, what do you say to people who might say, I get it, and stipulated, understood, those moments are crucial, but the price we risk paying for them by putting people in congregant living and more concentrated in campuses than they would be studying from home isn't worth the trade-off?
Well, I don't think that you can do it in isolation, meaning I think you have to do it with a really well thought out and holistic approach to safety. And that is inclusive of things like testing. So we're testing every member of our community every week, face coverings, right? We are mandating face coverings in the classroom, on campus, really anywhere outside of the residence hall or if a student is dining. Physical distancing, cleanliness. We're disinfecting, you know, all high-touch areas, including classrooms and bathrooms, every night on campus, as well as encouraging, you know, personal hygiene, hand washing, and we've got dispensers all over campus. So we've transformed our campuses in order to provide the safety that you need, I think, in order to return in a way that's appropriate. So I wouldn't, I don't think you can do this and just say, well, these things are so important, so let's just have them back. We have to have them back in a way that as best we can guarantee the safety of all members of the community.
We've heard a lot of stories about universities making one set of decisions, the cities and towns that they're in not liking those decisions and pushing back. We are in a public health situation where we're navigating these things together. So what's the right relationship between a college or a university and the city and or town it's located in making these decisions in advancing safety measures and in enforcement?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that I know keeps a lot of my colleagues around the country up at night. I don't know what the right relationship is. I think the right approach is constant communication and really being open to the concerns that municipalities have. There's really no substitute for that. We have an important job to do in bringing our students back so they can continue their progress toward their degree. Cities and towns have an important job to do in keeping their residents safe, and there are lots of areas that we can agree upon. And so I think open and transparent communication is the way to get through this.
And if there's a listener out there who's a faculty member at Stonehill or even another university where students are coming back into the classroom saying, I feel huge pressure and I don't want to be in the classroom because I don't feel safe. Maybe I'm at risk or someone in my family is high risk. What is your message to them right now?
Well, I can only tell you what we've done at Stonehill, and what we've done here is to say if you prefer to teach online, you can teach online. We haven't mandated in-person teaching from any of our faculty, and those that have chosen to teach online are teaching in just as a rigorous capacity as they were if they were on campus. Those who are on campus are teaching with models that work best for their safety. So we've physically distanced every classroom. We've added technology to all of our classrooms so that students, because we've also given our students a remote option and allowed them, if they prefer, to be home this semester but to access their courses remotely. So we've outfitted our classrooms with the technology that you need in order to do that. We've moved a good percentage of our classes fully online to accommodate, again, faculty and student concerns. And so I think that that approach has worked really well for us, and not mandating that the faculty return this fall has helped us reduce density in our buildings, which is another important thing to do to provide safety. Allowing students a remote option further reduced density in the residence halls and in our buildings. So we've lost a little bit of the Stonehill vibe, which is a very vibrant campus, and we've got a lot of students and faculty who are remote this semester. So we've lost a little bit of that, but we've gained in safety. And so I think, again, it's a humble approach. It really allows people to choose what they think is best for themselves and for their families, and at the same time, provide a rigorous education to our students.
Peter, as we've been following this over the months, one of the things that's been really striking is the increasing bitterness of the divide, both in primary and secondary education, over those who believe learners should be in classrooms now and those who believe they shouldn't. And I wonder, was that inevitable? Was it inescapable that we would have this bitter divide, or have we done something wrong somewhere along the way?
It's such a great question. I think that we live, even before the pandemic, as we live in a bitter moment. And, we very quickly want to assume the worst intentions from others. And so, what we've tried to do here is to acknowledge that this is a difficult time and that there are a variety of ways to get at a solution. I think it is more difficult at the secondary and elementary level, to be perfectly honest, than it is at the higher ed level, where you can more easily adapt with a mixture of online, in-person, hybrid, or high flex. I think we recognize that at our level that it's just easier to institute that, and the stakes are so much higher for families at an elementary level because it goes to a daily schedule for a family. It goes to daycare, it goes to childcare. And so I think some of the bitterness that we're seeing is a reflection of what happens when you make a decision for a school system, all the dominoes that fall, and the difficulty that many caregivers have as a result of that. So, you know, I understand why that bitterness is there. I do think in my experience, again, it's a limited one here at Stonehill, you know, that in listening to people and really trying to provide a safe educational experience, both remotely and in person, you know, has helped avoid some of the bitterness that we're seeing elsewhere.
I'm going to shift gears in a minute, Peter, but before I do, I want to ask you just one last question on this, which is, what are you still missing that you are most looking forward to getting back at some point if we ever return to the old normal or some semblance of it from this new normal?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm missing meeting with my colleagues in an impromptu way. I miss having students congregating around their faculty after class. You know, I miss seeing each other's face. You learn so much about human interaction by being able to talk, converse, to debate ideas and readings, and we're missing all of that. So, you know, I teach on Monday afternoons, and I had a great session with my students yesterday. It was really so wonderful to have them back, but we're all fully, you know, masked, and I have students joining remotely, and we all recognize that there's a little bit of our humanity that's missing as a result of that. And you know, that's not even the big things, right? We're not doing theater this fall. You can't do music and singing the way that we're used to. You know, you have to be more thoughtful just walking in and out of rooms than you had to be at the beginning of this year. And so I do think that we are all exhausted as a result of that, and really look forward to a moment when we can just converse, give, take, chat, and not have to worry about this virus.
Yeah, I admit that sounds really good. I said I wanted to shift gears. You are well known as an astute political observer, and since it's primary day, I'm going to ask you about this Kennedy-Markey race that people are watching so closely. It's just the way it has flipped, where we've got this long-serving member of the congressional delegation almost running as an outsider against a Kennedy who is more than 30 years younger. What do you make of that race? What's the headline?
I think the headline is that it's still very difficult to unseat an incumbent member of Congress. And even in this moment, when we see incumbents losing primary fights around the country, still, more often than not, incumbents who are running for renomination are in fact renominated. That's one headline. I think if there's a second, Ed Markey found his voice after all of these years in Congress. It took a really significant challenge for him to be able to articulate a passionate defense for his time in both the House and the Senate. And so he has surprised, I think, a lot of political observers. No matter how the race turns out tonight, it has surprised many people to hear this newly aggressive Ed Markey.
And Peter, historically, Kennedys and Massachusetts have won their elections. If Markey does win, what does that say about the power of the Kennedy name and the family in Massachusetts today?
Well, I think that the family, you know, is still going to be incredibly well regarded here. There are just some dynamics in this particular race that were unusual. I think Congressman Kennedy is very much beloved by a lot of folks, and has a bright future ahead. If he doesn't pull it off today, there's still possibilities for him down the road. You know, I think it can be overstated a little bit, and this is a unusual challenge even for a member of the Kennedy family, right? It's a challenge against a fairly popular incumbent United States senator. And that is a very difficult thing to do. Now, Markey has flipped the script here by pulling in the support from the progressive base of the Democratic Party in a way that has reshaped the race. But I don't think this spells the end of the Kennedy family's public service, and I don't think it spells the end of Joe Kennedy's commitment to public service either.
And Peter, just in our last 30 seconds or so, what else are you watching for today, or maybe tonight, or maybe tomorrow, or however long it takes for these results to come in?
You know, I think like everyone else, I'm watching to see if the upstart challengers to Richie Neal or Stephen Lynch can pull off a victory or keep it close. I doubt that victory is in the future for them. I think that the incumbents go in with a lot of strength. But we live in a topsy-turvy moment, and so it would be really interesting to see if in fact they do. It would be a huge upset for them both, but whether they even keep it close. The results in the fourth, you know, there's going to be a new member. That doesn't happen that often in Massachusetts, a new member of Congress, and so that will be an exciting race to watch. And I think overall turnout, to see if we can't figure out, you know, how voters are thinking about this fall. The numbers look like they're going to be pretty strong. The impact of early voting, you know, the impact of the pandemic in general is something that has made these races a little more difficult to predict. You know, going into the final week, more than half of the votes had already been sent in. That's really unusual for Massachusetts. So, you know, there's going to be a lot to unpack.
And that is Peter Ubertasio, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Stonehill College. Peter, it was great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great talking to you.